This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
On behalf of the entire evaluation team, my colleagues, Dr. Todd Gilmer right here, Sarah Hiller, who's over here in the on the side, Nev Jones, Dr. Sarah McMiniman, myself, I'm Vicky Ojeda, and our advisory group, we welcome you to the campus, and thank you so much for being a part of this very exciting activity. We would like to share with you a little bit more about the members also of the advisory group that helped inform this event. And some of those folks are listed on this slide and are here today as well. We want to just recognize that this conference, as well as this whole evaluation project, received support from the Mental Health Services Oversight and Accountability Commission. And so we're certainly indebted to them for making this possible. Finally, we'd also like to thank our colleagues from UCSD and from the community, as well as our special invited speakers for sharing their time with us and their expertise. And of course, we want to recognize all of you. I think you've had a chance to interact with us virtually, and we appreciate all of your participation in our surveys and just different email communications, and especially for sharing your time with us and all of your experiences. We hope to learn a lot from you, and we are looking forward to embarking on this journey where we hope to support TAE programming throughout California. And we actually have folks from the other parts of the country, so Dr. Trevor Manthe is here as well, and he's going to be sharing some experiences as well, but I think that we certainly have a lot to share with the community in the United States, so I think this is a very exciting time for us. Great. So let me get into our results. Let's see. So as many of you know, the Mental Health Services Act really allowed for a whole new array of services to be developed in California, and it's been about 10 years now since those programs have been implemented. We were contacted by the Mental Health Services Oversight and Accountability Commission and really asked to delve into what's happened in the last 10 years, what programs have emerged as a result of this new funding, because really, surprisingly, actually very little has been known about what's happened. And so the idea was to learn about not only what programs were implemented, but also what types of evaluation and quality improvement efforts have taken place during this past decade. So the overall evaluation goals are listed up here. And really, so our team set out to array the supportive services for TAE that were funded through MHSA. We're trying to look at evaluation quality improvement activities undertaken by TAE programs. And really, one of the key goals actually of this conference or this summit is to think about what methods can be recommended to the state as well as to the programs in order to improve quality improvement and evaluation activities that are being undertaken by different organizations. We'd also like to be thinking about what policies we might be recommending to the state in terms of these areas so that more effective strategies can be employed with TAE programming. So we wanted to share this with you just so that you know where we are in terms of the overall evaluation. And the phase one, which many of you participated in, was the TAE program surveys. And we also did county interviews, which were qualitative interviews, and we analyzed those data, and we'll be sharing those shortly. In the second phase, we are also looking at the recommendations for the best practices. And right now, we're actually in the third phase, which is the technical assistance component of the project. And we really hope to stimulate discussions and get feedback from all of you and learn from all of your expertise as to what is needed, what's feasible under the programming conditions that you are all operating under. And again, this was their TAE advisory group. In terms of the conference goals, what we'll be doing this morning is sharing what we found with respect to the survey data. And you'll actually find the fact sheets in your brochures in the registration packets. We'll also be providing technical assistance to help all of you with your evaluation and quality improvement activities. We hope to really stimulate networking, and so please feel free to do that. We've suggested to bring cards, but again, we'll be providing hopefully the contact information. And we're really seeking not just UCSD, but also to engage all of you in terms of new collaborations that are really focused on evaluation and quality improvement. And again, we'd really like to involve TAE more in all of these activities. So I think it's important to know who's here. And we've got about 50 providers, about 20 other stakeholders, 11 TAE. And there's about 105, 110 of you that are registered. So I think it's a really great turnout considering it's their first effort at doing this. So let's get into the methods. You may recall that just about a year ago, we compiled a directory of the counties and programs that were undertaking TAE programming. And so that's how we generated a list of respondents for the survey. And we fielded that survey last fall between September and December. We found that 41 counties are actually providing TAE-specific services. We had 180 participants that responded to the survey, and 39 counties were also responding in the qualitative interviews part. So we, again, want to thank all of you for participating in the survey. Without all of your feedback, there's no way that we could have done this conference today. In terms of the survey, you might recall that we asked for some of your demographic information. We asked about your program characteristics, including the region, where your funding is obtained, the target and priority populations that you work with, types of services that you offer, and then really the focus of our meeting today is to focus on the evaluation, the quality improvement, so we didn't collect some data on that as well. And finally, we asked you what your technical assistance needs were. And so I'll turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Todd Gilmer, and he'll talk about the results.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Ojeda. A wonderful introduction. And thank you all for coming and participating in this effort. I just want to echo Vicky's comments that we're delighted to have you here and really looking forward to kind of engaging you in this process. So our kind of personal goals are to help move the field forward for TAE in California and also nationwide, because this investment has been unprecedented, the number of programs that the states and the counties have supported. And so I think we have a lot to learn from each other, and I think others also have a lot to learn from us. As a result of the survey was designed around items that were of interest to the Mental Health Services Oversight and Accountability Commission, also to us and to our advisory group. And this is just an overview of the findings. We found of the 180 programs that responded that most were contracted nonprofit providers. That seems to be the predominance of the market for TAE programs in California. About 25% were directly operated and staffed by county agencies. Among the TAE specific programs, 45% were standalone programs, so programs that were TAE specific programs for the entire range of participants, and 55% were programs that were TAE specific services but embedded within a larger program that wasn't specific to only TAE. And on average, you know, clients range from 16 to 24 years. The sources of program funding were varied. So just about half of programs were funded under prevention and early intervention, and that will kind of determine to extent the objectives of the program and the range of services provided. 37% had funding under the FSP program, under community services and supports. But then there are other sources of funding, so other CSS funding, housing innovations, other MHSA funding, as well as EPSDT funding. So about a third of you also leverage EPSDT to provide services within your TAE program. But overall, most of the programs were funded all or in part by MHSA funding. And we found that echoed in our qualitative interviews that the MHSA provided essential support for developing the TAPE programs, both financial support, also some outlining a stakeholder process, raising awareness, getting people engaged. So very, very helpful piece of legislation for the youth programs. We asked questions about the target population. 70% of the programs indicated that they specifically targeted individuals with serious mental illness. Another 70% dual mental illness and substance use. So you can see you can respond to multiple categories. That's why it'll be over 100% if you would add them up. But really a focus on SMI and dual SMI and substance use. 66% of programs indicated priority population of youth who were homeless or at risk of homelessness. Youth aging out of foster care, becoming emancipated from foster care families were target population, as well as youth exiting criminal justice system or having histories with the justice system, and the youth residing in institutional or residential care. So really a focus on the most vulnerable youth in these programs. Also a very diverse target population with respect to race ethnicity. So 51% of the programs conducted outreach to Latino youth, 44% for African American youth, 34% for Asian American youth, Native American and Alaskan Native, 32% of the program. So a much higher percentage that's in the population overall. So additional outreach being made to Native American communities. Similarly with Pacific Islander communities and Native Hawaiian communities. So again, in addition to focus on youth, it's focusing on youth with diverse racial ethnic characteristics. And other priority populations were identified in the survey. So LGBTQ populations were a priority for many programs. Also, TAE, who were parents or expecting to become parents, were a target of programs. And we observed some specific programming around parenting TAE. Undocumented youth were of interest to, you know, over a third of the programs. Some programs focused on youth who were veterans. And then there were others. And here it describes the range of services offered by programs. So I guess I'd like to emphasize here the diversity, both in the scope of services provided and the very high percentages of services provided by programs. So for most categories, over 50% of the programs were providing these types of services. So it is a really wide array. You know, behavioral health care would be kind of the standard, you know, mental health and substance use services that we'd think about providing in the public mental health system. 63% providing physical health care. And so this could be a range of services from screening to consultations from physician to other more intensive testing to wellness activity education. So very interesting array of physical health care services. Educational support, and this could range from coordination with local schools and community colleges and high schools to full supported education programs. Benefit management, managing, you know, eligibility for SSI and other public assistance. Financial management, so these would be directly financial skills, banking skills, saving, and so on. And employment support, 54%. So everything from you know, job kind of ability screening to job counseling to individual placement and support, so supported employment. 63% provided basic services, so help with laundry or obtaining clothing and so on. 48% provided housing support, so something that we know is very important to youth, especially those emancipating from foster care, but also just at that stage of life needing to be independent and having a challenge finding housing in the San Diego area. Social support services were also very high, so this would be social skills training and other types of recreational activities to try to kind of enrich social lives of youth. Your family-oriented services, so family therapies and other family reunification activities 80%, so very high. Mentoring support is 60%. So a lot of this is peer mentoring. There's also some formal mentoring and supporting natural mentors. So kind of a diverse array of mentoring support and peer support. And this would be the most common thing in this category is peer support groups. But there were about a half dozen types of peer support also provided in these programs. And we'll make the more detailed categories available on the website as well. But I'd just like to congratulate you on the wide range of services provided. It's kind of very exciting kind of being here in California today and kind of pushing the envelope on the range of services being made available. But the remaining gaps. So the survey asked you about what do you thought were the most important remaining gaps in services for youth. We also asked county administrators where they felt the gaps were. These are your responses. So the most common gap in housing and homeless services. So we do hear this, that even though substantial housing funding was provided, we need more. I mean, housing is expensive. It's a challenge. There's a great need in this community for housing. Interesting also, behavioral health services were listed as a gap. So even though 91% of programs provided behavioral health, there was still some thought that there were gaps remaining in the availability of that care. And that's something we're going to be kind of working with you to kind of look into a bit more detail to see what specifically could be helpful. So some gaps in employment support and educational support, and also drop-in wellness centers and parenting and childcare. So the MHSOAC was also very interested in programs' efforts at evaluating their services and in quality improvement. And that's an emphasis of the Mental Health Services Act overall. But I think it's particularly important for us because there is, as we'll see later on today, a lack of evidence base for youth programs. They're fairly new compared to child programs and adult programs, and we're still working on figuring out what works. And I think with all of you out there kind of in the field kind of trying to implement these programs, you're learning a lot, you know, personally about what works and what is a challenge. And we think it would be helpful kind of to hear from you and to kind of be able to share that information among all of us. We asked you about your use of evaluations. We also asked counties about their evaluation activities. We focused on two types of evaluations. So formative evaluations allowed for feedback during the implementations of the programs. These would include things that you have heard of called needs assessment and process evaluations are common terms for these. Summative evaluations would kind of occur at the end. To try to figure out, was the program effective? Did it meet its goals? Did it improve client outcomes? What is the overall impact? What is the cost effectiveness of the program? So when we look at evaluations, we see these as very important complementary components, the formative and summative, or also often looked at as process and outcomes. And we thought you were very active in these areas. So especially the TAPE programs involved in both formative and summative evaluations at a very high level. So 88% doing formative evaluations and 92% doing summative evaluations. Counties were also very active in evaluation activities, but more focused on outcomes. So they were less focused on process of care. And that makes sense to some extent in that as programs, you're very much involved in what's going on day to day. You know what processes you're doing, and you know it would be important to measure. Counties might be a little bit once removed from that, looking at a variety of programs, and they might be more challenged to know what to measure with respect to process. But we think it highlights an area for potential increased collaboration between programs and counties, in that programs can share their expertise in the process evaluation, and counties can help out sometimes in measuring outcomes that programs don't have access to. And that's kind of reflected here in the sources of data that are used for evaluation. So you see some discrepancy in what's available to counties versus programs. So counties have better access and more use of administrative data than programs, though programs are involved in that as well. Clinician-reported data and client-reported data are two sources that are used both by both counties and programs. Qualitative data used a little bit less. We think there's probably room to do some more qualitative work. Qualitative work takes a lot of effort and a lot of time, you know, to record and code and report. And so I think that is kind of reflected in the lower use of it. But we'd like to help work with you to figure out what are most cost-efficient strategies to do some qualitative work. As far as reviewing data, data is reviewed fairly often, 70 to 80% quarterly. The most common design is a pre-post design, looking before and after program entry. A little less use of longitudinal designs, other comparative designs. So again, we think this is an area we could help kind of move the field forward with some help from you and some outside resources. Here are the outcome categories. So a wide array of outcomes are being considered by programs and counties. So client goals, criminal justice system encounters, education, employment, of course, behavioral health services. Specific client outcome measures were used, although quite a diverse array of measures, psychosocial outcomes and housing outcomes. So a pretty broad spectrum of indicators being used by programs. As far as resources allocated to program evaluation, so about half of county representatives indicated they had a dedicated staff or team to program evaluation. And on average, these had about 5 staff members assigned to them. And this definitely was related to the size of the county. So larger counties had more resources to and probably greater efficiencies with having evaluation staff. Smaller counties, certainly lower budgets overall, found that to be a greater challenge. Few programs are actually able to find out the specific amount they spent on these activities. So we're also similarly interested in the use of quality improvement among programs. So as a kind of a complement to evaluation is using that data to improve the quality of programs. And so here's some definitions of quality improvement. We're looking at systematic and continuous activities that lead to measurable improvements. So QI is an ongoing process. So evaluation, you might think of an evaluation as kind of a discrete point in time, but QI likes to take that and implement it over an ongoing basis, and the spirit becomes a bit different. So rather than worrying about just did this one effort work or not, kind of incorporating that knowledge into ongoing quality improvement, trying to figure out why it didn't work, if it didn't work, or if it did, why it did work, and being able to kind of, incorporate that as you move forward. So implementing a QI program involves systems and processes. You want to do something kind of on an ongoing basis. Again, we're looking at things that are important to patients and improve outcomes. Typically, these involve complex team processes and ultimately result in improved strategies to improve the quality of care. Programs and counties are very much involved in quality improvement. Certainly, TAE programs, for the most part, have TAE-specific QI. Counties have similar levels of QI overall. They're doing a little bit less TAE-specific quality improvement. And here are the stated goals among counties and programs. Both counties and programs are interested or focus their QI efforts on improving existing services. Programs tend to be more often to identify new needed services and identify new populations. And a little bit more activity on counties in assessing model fidelity. I think that's an area that has some promise. We've had some success looking at fidelity among full service partnership programs and certainly found the FSP for TAE programs with higher fidelity to the Housing First model had greater reductions in inpatient care and other things we're trying to avoid. So we think there's additional probably opportunities for fidelity assessment and FSPs and supported education, supported employment, and so on. And also maybe again for some more collaboration between counties and programs, where the programs are doing a little bit more in identifying new needed services and new populations, and hopefully that can be provided as information back to the counties if it's not already. Models of quality improvement. So one thing we found was that there wasn't really a lot of standard quality improvement model use. So everyone was doing it and everyone was kind of doing it in their own way. That might be the best way to do it. But we think it might also be good to promote some more standardized approaches. to it. And one is common is the Plan, Do, Study, Act model. And we'll be talking a little bit about that, Dr. Andy Sarkin, later today in one of the breakout sessions, how to use that model with some SMART goals. A little bit of, a few other models used, but for the most part, no specific model is used. The advantage of using the kind of model as well is that if you found something that works well, then we can tell other programs and counties about it, you know, what you're doing, what your best practices are, and that would help everyone else. Resources are pretty similar for evaluation. A little bit more over half of counties had a dedicated quality improvement staff, and these had about, four staff members assigned to it. And again, associated with county size. So I think there's some opportunities for maybe collaboration among small counties to develop some evaluation and QI resources that might be shared. Again, not a lot of counting of the specific resources that went to this. So it might be often that you have QI staff that also have other demands on their time and parts of QI. And so then it gets hard saying, what am I exactly spending on QI and evaluation? So we're not entirely sure you want to know that. I mean, we think it would be helpful. We don't want to, make it a lot of work to figure out what it is, on the other hand. But it might be good to be able to start sharing that information, saying, figuring out, well, for a county of getting this given size, how much should we be investing? What's a good rule of thumb? We're also very interested in involvement of TAE in program planning and governance. And this will be emphasis of one of the first breakout sessions as well, getting TAE more involved in program planning. There does seem to be some efforts already. So among the 180 providers, 66% involved TAE in service planning, 48% members of an advisory group or council, 44% involved in planning and implementation, and so on. So the lowest percentage of as having TAE involved is members of the governing body. And so that seems certainly to be one area that we could improve upon. So the summary of what have we found? So we found that counties and programs have implemented a wide range of supported services for TAE, that they're very active in evaluation and quality improvement. But there's a limited evidence base for TAE services, and also lack of consistency among evaluative and QI methods and measures. So, we've really, as MHSA has been implemented, it's been very decentralized, very much at the county level, left to kind of figure things out for themselves. And so there hasn't been as much direction about what should be measured, but we're hoping kind of we can do this in a collaborative way and have some suggestions about some common approaches, some common measures, so that everyone can compare their results. And I think an interesting thing about the context, and this is probably obvious to you, but it was kind of interesting to us to kind of discover on our own and just realize that, county programs have traditionally been children and adults, and each county will have a lot of those kinds of programs. The TAE programs are newer, and there's fewer of them. It's a, smaller demographic overall. And so we really think there's a need to look outward. So rather than just communicating with people in your county, to reach across counties and communicate with colleagues in other places. And I know you've done a lot of this already, and certainly with some of the service planning, there was some initial efforts on it, but we also heard there's been some ongoing challenges to keep that going. So we're hoping to catalyze this a bit today and then hear back from you on, how can we keep this going? How can we keep our networking and cross-learning effective? And some of these are the recommendations we have. And I'll walk through these a little bit, some specifics. So increasing comparability and efficiency of your evaluation and QI efforts, engaging in collaborative efforts together to help build the evidence base for TAE services, and to provide ongoing support for those, and for those of you who are interested in doing that. And so a lot of the conference is around trying to meet some of these objectives. We're not going to solve everything today, but we're hoping to get it started and for areas that people are really excited about to help support that going forward. So we will have a session on implementing a standard recovery-based measure for TAE. We won't do that today, but we will hopefully start the conversation about what is a good measure, what should we talk about, and we're going to propose a process over the next few months to kind of evaluate some measures and come up with recommendations, and you're all welcome to be involved with that, whether or not you attend that breakout. We also think we need to improve access to flexible data management and reporting. And so some of this is kind of things that need to be done at the county level, but maybe at the state level as well. You know, so if we're going to implement this new outcomes measure, well, I need a database to put it in so I can track it and share it with other people in a way that maintains confidentiality. And we also like to promote standard models of quality improvement. And Dr. Sarkin will talk about that and the resources that will be available for that moving forward. As far as engaging in collaborative efforts, certainly all you being here today is a good start. We're going to have a couple sessions focused specifically around supported education and also engagement of peers, where we think there's really a fertile ground to develop new evaluations and new studies of what you're doing, either observing what you're doing now or experimenting with something new that can add to the evidence base. So we're certainly open to doing other collaborative efforts in other areas that you suggest as well. And also the increase of fidelity tools. So I talked about supported education, employment, FSPs are some examples where we can use fidelity to better compare what the FSPs look like across programs, what are your supported education efforts look like. And you can imagine combining a fidelity tool with an outcomes tool, you can start to figure out what works. So what is the effectiveness of my intensive program? What is the effectiveness of my kind of less intensive but more broadly applied program? You know, how do I want to divide the resources among those efforts, which you need both? And then providing ongoing support. So we had many quotes that were kind of along these lines, but saying that it's really difficult to know what I'm doing, if I'm measuring the right thing, how I'm performing compared to my colleagues. So we want to promote friendly competition here, but it's good to know these things. And certainly any of you that run, you know, very successful programs know you faced failures and challenges. And I think having this kind of data lets you just know that sooner and make changes quicker. So I'll stop now. I've done a lot of talking, and we'd love to field questions, certainly about the research findings we presented today, anything else about our evaluation so far, or anything out about goals moving forward. We've given you note cards. And so I think the plan is that if you have a question, to write it down on the note card, and then we'll collect those, and then we'll answer them to the best of our ability.
As a point of clarification,
yes.
We're talking about counties as opposed to TAE programs. Were
right.
For those county-run TAE programs versus contracted TAE programs?
No, they weren't. They're actually counties. So surveyed 180 TAE programs, and about a quarter of those were county-owned and operated, but we considered that a TAE program. Right, so I'm sorry for that confusion earlier on. So those are all programs. In counties, we interviewed 39 counties, focusing on either the MHSA director, or in larger counties, we had people that actually implemented the TAE programs, or TAE program director, whoever is knowledgeable about what was done at that time. And so that data is derived from those interviews. And so we found kind of often parallel efforts going on among counties and programs. And I guess what we hadn't explored was how much exchange of information was going on, but we had a sense there could be some improvements in the information exchange. I got an icebreaker. Thank you. Yeah, I believe there are 52 California counties. Did you have all respond to your survey? Almost. There are actually, I think, 53 mental health service areas. So almost every county has their own mental health services area. And there are, I think, one county that has an extra one, and another two counties are combined. But we did contact all of them, and we interviewed 39, and we found that others, about 12, did not have TAE-specific programs. We obviously didn't do any surveying there. But then among the counties that did have programs, we had extremely high response rates from almost all of the counties. I think near 100% or over 90% response rate. The exception was Los Angeles County. So our largest county is also the largest challenge to get providers to respond. I think the county infrastructure there is so large and decentralized, it's harder to get everyone engaged. They did make a valiant effort. The response rate, though, was about 30%. On the one hand, LA might be a little underrepresented, but it's such a large county that if everyone did respond, then they would kind of overwhelm the data. So we'll look on the bright side. But we got great response rates from every other county, and so we're really, really appreciative of that. It was mentioned there was 180 participants. Is there a list of those individuals? We do have a list of the programs, and we hadn't thought about whether we should post that. And we could. And we could send out a survey, I guess, to everybody and let anybody opt out that wants to. Some bit of a challenge. I mean, contacts will change. I mean, you must all know that you do switch programs fairly regularly. And so we have had some bounce backs. But we can list, like, who responded, the county, give some contact information for people who are there. That's a great idea. We'll also be sending a survey out at the end of the conference to get your response. So I know often you get a handout in your folder, and we all kind of admonish you to encourage you to fill that out before you leave. But we're going to send you a survey later and to kind of gauge your how effective you thought this was and what you'd like to do going forward and so on. So what were the common quality improvement models used? And of those models, what is the recommended process to implement at the county level? Very good question. We found out for the most part, most counties and programs did not use a standard model of QI. The most common model was the Plan, Do, Study, Act model. But that was still used by less than 20%. I think when we talked to counties about what they did, it was still along those lines of Plan, Do, Study, Act is fairly general. It's really talking about what you plan to do, setting goals. And Dr. Sarkin will talk this afternoon at a breakout session in this room about setting SMART goals, about using the PDSA cycle. And I think for the most part, the programs that aren't using a specific model are essentially using elements of that. But it's nice to kind of standardize that and to kind of documents it, and so you have roadmaps for your next project or for the people that come after you in the QI unit. And also you can begin to share those with your colleagues. So if you found that you did something that worked really well and you did it in a standardized way that you documented, well, then you can almost hand it off as a report to a colleague, and they might be able to implement it in a fairly standard, similar way. Our focus tomorrow is on performance improvement projects. So I don't know if any of you have been involved in PIPs already. Okay, so this is a brave new world of performance improvement projects, and they are essentially quality improvement projects that are required by the state. So we thought it was a kind of a nice a dovetail in that you've got your counties are required to do PIPs. They've become kind of increasing a bit of a challenge to do with the requirements and documentation. And so we thought we would develop some TAE-specific PIPs here as part of this conference that then you can take back to your counties, or if your counties are here, and they could implement them. So they would get the advantage of having something that was fairly well developed, and then they could use also later to adapt to new PIPs. And then there would be some incentive from them to do something TAE-specific. So we're not aware of any counties doing a TAE-specific PIP yet. But after this and conference, and hopefully by December, we'll have them fully developed, and they'll have options for doing that, and mostly off the shelf. Oh, yes, sir. Thank you. Do you know what the breakdown is of behavioral health care? So, for example, what percent were medication only? Was family therapy offered? What percent offered group therapy, and what kinds of groups were offered? Were there LGBTQ specialized groups? And what attempts were made to integrate physical health and behavioral health care in the same site? Those are all very good questions. And we do have answers to some of those. So I provided the overall slide with the general categories, 91% have behavioral health care, for example. I forgot what it was, but a large percentage also did some physical health care. And we also have a report where we provide then the detail in each of those categories. So, among, behavioral health care, how much offered medication, how much offered group therapy. We also have some data on specific evidence-based manualized therapies, for example, cognitive behavioral therapy, trauma-informed CBT, and so on. And so we'll make that available on the website. So we're really going to use this website as a vehicle to disseminate more information. We'll post the presentations, the webs, some of these reports, and we'll send out notices to you, to all the registrants when they're posted. Some of the stuff we don't know yet. I mean, I don't know. We do know programs that did outreach to LGBTQ youth, but we don't know to the extent they use specialized groups for that. But certainly this is kind of a forum where if we have enough folks interested in knowing that, we can, you know, do supplemental surveys to programs, for example, ones that, you know, did specific outreach to LGBTQs, and to ask what they do specifically. So we could work with you to develop the survey, what would be the appropriate questions to ask, and then we could field it. And if you get tired of the surveys, you can always opt out. But then we could have that information, and that'd be great. So as we did our best I can to get what we thought was important without making the survey too burdensome on you. I know there's certainly those trade-offs, right? The more information you want to know and the more time you have to spend doing the survey, but we expected some other things to come up, and we can do some of these specialized inquiries. Of TAPE programs, counties that provided housing, well-level care was housing linked to, for example, FSP, outpatient, and so on. I think mostly, as you expect, most of it was linked with FSPs, although there were some separate housing programs. So there are, there are, I think, 10% of programs were actually funded under the housing stream. And I think for the most part, they focus just on housing. A lot of it was with the FSPs. But then, you know, there would be a variety of ways to provide housing through FSPs as well. So there's permanent supported housing. There's more transitional housing. There is just more kind of searching around for, you know, what housing might be available. So we'll have that also listed in the more detailed report. What we would miss is, you know, to the extent you sometimes will have different programs collaborating, so you might have a standalone housing program that collaborates then with outpatient programs, FSPs, and so on. I know that's common in Los Angeles County, I think maybe in San Francisco County. So we'll have some more detail, and then you can kind of get back with us if you have a more specific question about the housing approach. We also have some detail on fidelity, the housing first model among TAE FSPs, and that gives some detail among specific housing approaches. You know, are readiness requirements applied? You know, do the TAE have roommates? That seems to be more common than among adults, and so on. So sources of funding, so 10% housing, our programs using MHSA funds, collaborating with HUD programs or other sources. So I think I talked a little bit to that. So we have some information on that, but it sounds like there might be interest in knowing more. I mean, I know when I talk to my colleagues in San Diego County, it's been kind of a challenge to figure out how to do housing, and they've kind of been very creative about using different approaches. And so maybe this is a target we want to focus on, get a kind of a forum going on what are the most, you know, what are some success strategies around finding housing for youth. Okay, we can do a few more questions if you have them. We have one here. Okay, good question. Ideas about using data and evaluation to help programs advocate to keep funding directed to serve moderate to severe mental health needs when there's a pressure to direct services to youth who are in acute and often chronic crisis. That's a very good question. You know, it seems that our system is really set up, right, to direct most resources to acute care treatment strategies. And, you know, I think there is. I mean, certainly, I think about the two common types of programs for youth. It might be on the CSS side would be either FSPs or outpatient models. So kind of standard outpatient models, but that are case specific. So they're limited to that age range. They have some therapies that are specifically geared towards youth groups or youth specific and so on. And I think by kind of documenting the outcomes among these programs, you can make an argument for their effectiveness. So we have done a couple studies of these programs in San Diego County. We found that youth that entered these programs had a much higher use of mental health services. So, it's hard to infer exactly from that they were better off. But we do know they're more engaged in outpatient care when it's a youth-specific program. And we also did some qualitative work with these programs, and we found that they've liked them. Certainly much better than adult programs. They resonated more, but there were still limitations. So they still described kind of additional need for youth-specific therapies and groups and things that really spoke to what they were interested in. So rather than things just everything being a dual diagnosis group to being groups around relationships and falling in love and other things like that that were important to them. And so I think kind of doing studies like that, I think, can kind of demonstrate both the value and also, again, help you engage in QI and improve those. And so I think by getting the feedback from youth in a regular way and incorporating them into the service planning and perhaps even the governance, you'll have that voice and you'll continue to be relevant. And certainly as you build your youth advocacy then in your county, they can also have a voice and advocate for you and advocate for youth-specific programs. Certainly there needs to be an array of programs. We don't want to have just serve one subset of youth. We really want to have the services that are available for the wide range of needs and interests. Okay, so if there's anyone else that has a card that they're finishing up, I'll take a question, but otherwise we'll probably wrap this up. Certainly we are open to ongoing feedback. I often think of things, as I'm driving home from a conference, and we're going to provide a forum for you to then provide feedback, or maybe you don't feel comfortable doing it in the group setting. But anyways, there's going to be more opportunities, and we're going to kind of keep this going, and we're going to look for you to say, this would be a good way to keep this going. I mean, we don't want to just set up some process that isn't helpful or just too burdensome to keep track of, but maybe it ends up being kind of small interest groups that are kind of time limited. For example, it might be something that we do. But certainly we'll look forward to your feedback throughout the day and throughout the coming year. So thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.